KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says Vladimir Putin is, quote, absolutely crazy as Russia hits Ukraine with another major missile strike. But he again blamed Volodymyr Zelensky for the war. What's it mean for ceasefire talks? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump's plan to stop Harvard from enrolling international students is paused for now. May Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A Harvard scholar compares the administration to authoritarian governments that try to control universities. Also, the story of two World War II generals who received the Medal of Honor, one who left the Philippines as the Japanese advanced, and another who took over and stayed. It is Monday, May 26th. On this day in 1896, Charles Dow picked 12 stocks to represent the American economy, the original Dow Jones Industrial Average. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A ceremony honoring the nation's fallen service members is getting underway at Arlington National Cemetery at this hour. NPR's Ava Pukach reports President Trump will take part in a wreath-laying ceremony and deliver remarks.
The 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, also known as the Old Guard, placed American flags at more than 260,000 headstones. And on Sunday, visitors placed flowers at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and at grave sites throughout the more than 600-acre cemetery. The first Decoration Day, now known as Memorial Day, was held at Arlington National Cemetery in 1868. Service members from every major American war dating back to the Revolutionary War are interred at the cemetery. Recent presidents have typically participated in a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier on Memorial Day, honoring fallen service members and commemorating their sacrifices. Ava Pukach, NPR News.
The head of a new U.S.-backed aid program for Gaza has resigned, saying the initiative does not adhere to humanitarian principles. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports the director's resignation puts into question the future of assistance in the region.
Jake Wood, a U.S. Army veteran, says he's resigning from leading the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. In a statement, he said it's not possible to implement the plan while also strictly adhering to principles of humanity and neutrality. The plan, backed by the U.S., is supposed to replace how food is delivered in Gaza amid rampant hunger. It's come under criticism from the UN and aid groups, who say the program would limit civilians' access to aid and serve Israeli military goals. Israel says the program will keep aid away from Hamas, concentrating aid mostly in southern Gaza with Israeli soldiers guarding nearby. The U.S.-backed aid group says it will maintain humanitarian principles and will begin delivering aid in Gaza Monday. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
As the summer travel season kicks into high gear, airports across the nation are once again being pushed to their limits. NPR's Joel Rose reports staffing shortages and outdated technology at Newark Liberty International Airport are adding to the uncertainty.
The FAA has now capped the number of flights in and out at Newark at a level that the agency says is more in line with what air traffic control can handle. The FAA says it's working to install new fiber optic lines and adding new backup systems to help with the technical problems in Newark. The FAA says it's also trying to speed up hiring and training of new air traffic controllers. But, you know, the reality is that it takes years to train them to work in complex and congested airspace.
That's NPR's Joel Rose reporting. This is NPR News in Washington. Swedish carmaker Volvo has announced that it's cutting an estimated 3,000 jobs globally. The company says it's part of a move to address declining demand for electric vehicles and an increase in operational costs. The layoffs will impact about 1,200 workers in Sweden. The remaining reductions will occur across other international markets. Food apps that rate the healthfulness of packaged foods have become increasingly popular. You can scan the food's barcode with your phone, and the app will rank it for its nutritional content. As NPR's Maria Godoy reports, dietitians say they can be helpful with some caveats.
Lindsay Moyer is a registered dietitian with the Center for Science in the Public Interest. She says food apps can put more information in the hands of consumers. If you use them, she says, look for ones that rank food for overall nutrition rather than focusing on single ingredients. And she says, take the results with a grain of salt.
It's important not to panic, because some of the way that these apps rate food additives in the ingredients list, it's a little bit overblown. This may not be a safety concern or a reason not to eat the food.
And remember, some of the healthiest foods, like fruits and vegetables, often don't come with a barcode. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Republican lawmakers in Texas are closer to passing legislation that would require classrooms in public schools to display the Ten Commandments. The bill passed by a wide margin in the State House on Sunday. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, we'll speak with a Harvard professor who argues that President Trump is being authoritarian in his attempts to slash funding and control some aspects of school governance.
First, though, Russia has launched massive drone and missile assaults on Ukrainian cities over the weekend.
The attacks happened over the past three nights, even as the two countries carried out the largest prisoner exchange since Russia's full-scale invasion began more than 3 years ago. President Trump criticized the strikes while also repeating his claim that this war would have never started under his watch.
Joining us to talk about all this is NPR's Joanna Kakissis, who's in Kyiv. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning, Michelle.
So let's start with Russia's latest drone and missile strikes. What can you tell us?
So Russia launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Ukrainian cities over the past 3 days, and these attacks have killed at least a dozen people, including children, and injured many more, and also destroyed homes. And so here in Kyiv, we consider ourselves lucky if, after all that, we are only sleep-deprived. Here's what woke me up last night. That's the sound of Ukraine's air defenses shooting down drones buzzing over our neighborhood.
Joanna, I've been hearing you report on these attacks just about every day, and they seem to be escalating. So why has Russia intensified its attacks in recent weeks?
So, Michelle, we don't really have a clear answer, but this all happened after the Trump administration brokered a 30-day ceasefire proposal in March. Ukraine agreed to it, but Russia refused unless the West stopped sending weapons to Ukraine. And now last month, Russian missiles hit near a playground in one Ukrainian city and the crowded downtown of another city, killing 53 civilians in all, including several children. After this weekend's attacks, President Trump criticized Russian President Vladimir Putin on social media, saying Putin had, quote, gone absolutely crazy. But Trump also slammed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and former President Biden and insisted they were also to blame for the war.
So considering all this, have the diplomatic efforts to end the war made any headway at all?
In terms of ending the war, no. As I said, Russia has not even agreed to a ceasefire, even after talks between Ukraine and Russia in Istanbul. A couple of weeks ago, the only breakthrough out of those talks was an agreement to exchange 1,000 prisoners of war from each country, an exchange which took place this weekend.
And you were there for this latest prisoner exchange. Tell us about that. What kind of condition were the Ukrainians in?
So, Michelle, they all looked sickly and gaunt. Their clothes were just hanging off them. Their heads were shaved. We don't know yet what these soldiers endured in Russian captivity, but other Ukrainians imprisoned by Russia have described horrific conditions. They were starved, beaten, and tortured.
And what was the scene as these soldiers came home?
Well, it was incredibly moving and also heartbreaking. Families were gathered in this leafy courtyard in northern Ukraine, waiting to see if their loved ones would be among the soldiers getting off these chartered buses. 18-year-old Milena Moroz held a photo of her father, who has been missing since February, and she broke down when we talked. She's saying, I wish I'd told him, I love you, Dad. When the buses carrying the soldiers arrived, the families rushed to hug them as they walked out. One young soldier, Anton Kobilnik, told us he'd been in captivity for 3 years. He's saying, I won't really feel like I'm at home until I see my mom. We only saw a handful of these reunions. However, Michelle, most family members were left waiting in tears, including 18-year-old Milena Moroz. Her father is still missing.
Oh, it's just tragic. That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, thank you.
You're welcome.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's move to revoke Harvard University's ability to enroll international students, but the future remains uncertain. In recent days, we've been hearing from Harvard students and faculty. Today, Stephen Levitsky joins me. Levitsky conducts research on authoritarian governments and leads the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. Stephen, you wrote in 2018 the book How Democracies Die, where you warned that the Trump administration was acting like an authoritarian government, and you say it's happening again. What's different, if anything, this time around?
Oh, this time is much, much more authoritarian. Trump, when he won the first time around, didn't expect to win, didn't have a plan, didn't have a team in place, and was compelled to govern with more or less mainstream Republicans and conservative technocrats, and they constrained him. Trump was always very authoritarian. His instincts were always very authoritarian, but he was surrounded by folks who largely constrained him. This time around, a very, very different story. Had a team, had a plan, put in place a government that did not, full of loyalists and people who have a very authoritarian agenda. And he's completely unconstrained in his authoritarianism, except for by the courts. So this is an all-out authoritarian assault, the likes of which we haven't seen in this country probably ever.
Are there any historical precedents with governments elsewhere trying to control schools in an authoritarian way? How do those moments compare to this one?
Frankly, this has been a more aggressive assault on universities than we've seen in other elected authoritarian governments in the 21st century. This is something that really all authoritarians do, left-wing, centrist, right-wing. Autocrats don't like universities because universities are, in most countries, culturally influential centers of dissent. Universities are always voices of dissent. And so autocrats, whether it's right-wing autocrats in Hungary or left-wing autocrats in Nicaragua and Venezuela, almost invariably go after universities. This is straight out of the authoritarian playbook.
Now, the U.S. has a track record for attracting the best and brightest. Immigrants have won 40% of Nobel Prizes awarded to Americans between the year 2000 and 2023. That's according to analysis from the nonpartisan and nonprofit National Foundation for American Policy. Why go after, Stephen, universities, the institutions that actually attract these best and brightest minds?
Well, this is a government that is ethno-nationalist. It is turning inward. It's not interested in the kinds of international exchanges, trade, travel in and out of the country that governments in the United States consistently since World War II have engaged in. This is an inward-oriented government that is much more interested in consolidating power than in building capacity or building wealth for the future. I mean, trade policy is very similar. This is consistent with other policies. This is a government that is rapidly breaking what has made this country great since World War II.
How does a ban on international students impact Harvard and beyond? I know financially it would be a big hit, but I mean, what are the impacts that we're talking about here?
Financial is the least of it, quite frankly. We are an international university. We have 7,000 foreign students and a huge number of foreign visitors and professors. We've absolutely feed on international exchange, on the ability of our own members to travel abroad, to do research abroad, and to bring in the best and the brightest, again, scholars, students from every part of the world. That is what makes, in part, this country great, and it's what makes higher education in the United States great. We could not be Harvard, as we've known it since World War II, without international exchange. We would cease to be a great university almost overnight.
You teach international students at Harvard. What are they telling you about this moment?
They're terrified. About 80% of my students, of my graduate students, are international, most of them from Latin America. And they are, as you can imagine, suffering total uncertainty about their future. These are the folks who have spent years of their lives preparing for this, working to get into Harvard, to get a degree from Harvard, and don't know where they're going to be, whether they're going to be here in the fall. Their futures are completely up in the air. Many of them have challenging financial circumstances and are never imagined that they'd be faced with this challenge.
Stephen Levitsky is a professor of government and director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. Stephen, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
In honor of Memorial Day, we ask listeners to share stories about service members and their families who lost their lives. We'll start with the story of Theodore King Higgins. While stationed in San Diego in 1964, he received Navy orders to go to Vietnam. Here's his daughter, Catherine, from Oregon.
He was lost at sea when his A-4 Skyhawk crashed into the sea while on approach to the USS Von Hom Richard.
Catherine was 3 years old when her father died.
My mother always said that Ted was a true patriot, that he died for our country. And I don't remember my father, but I do know that he was smart and he was quiet, and he died so that Americans can live in freedom.
Hope Sutton from North Carolina remembers her father, Carl Sutton, and her grandfather, Hans George Fulton. She says her grandfather was a pacifist who volunteered to serve in World War II.
He was a mechanical engineer who led troops that went into towns after they were reclaimed.
Their job was to go around and find all of the booby traps or any types of explosives left behind by the Germans.
Sutton's father, Carl Sutton, served in the Army.
Although he did not fight in Vietnam, he was exposed to Agent Orange during his service, and he subsequently passed away from leukemia.
Kirsten Foster from Michigan spoke about her great uncle, Private First Class John Francis Rise. He lied about his age in order to serve in World War II, and he was just 16 years old.
He became a paratrooper.
He participated in the Battle of the Bulge and then unfortunately was killed in action during his first and last jump during Operation Varsity, which was the largest airborne operation of World War II. My family was only ever told that he was dead before he hit the ground.
Rise was 18 years old.
He was just a kid who was in an extraordinary situation and ended up paying the ultimate price because he thought it was the right thing to do. Great Uncle John is a hero who I hope many others will now be thinking about and remembering this Memorial Day.
These are just a few of the stories of the many service members we celebrate on this day. This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview about the life and legacy of Sly Stone. Questlove talks about his documentary Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius, on Hulu. Questlove won the Oscar for another of his music documentaries, Summer of Soul. Join us. Makes no difference what group I'm in.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. On this Memorial Day, we remember an American soldier who suffered defeat. He's linked in history with an American known for victory. Jonathan Horn wrote a book about both of them, including the American known for glory.
Douglas MacArthur is perhaps one of the most famous generals in American history. And I think what he's most famous for are those three words he said when he was ordered to leave the Philippines in 1942 by President Roosevelt, "I shall return."
MacArthur was considered the greatest American soldier. At the start of World War II, he commanded U.S. forces in the Philippines, which were trapped by a Japanese attack. MacArthur was told to flee so Japan would not enjoy a propaganda victory by capturing him.
But very little is known about the general who took command after Douglas MacArthur left. His name was General Jonathan Wainwright, and he also made a vow, and his vow was to stay with his men and share their fate, even when it meant becoming the highest-ranking American prisoner of World War II.
Years later, MacArthur did return with forces to the Philippines, but the heart of Jonathan Horn's book, The Fate of the Generals, is the general he left behind, with American troops who couldn't escape in 1942. Wainwright, like MacArthur, had come from a military family and embraced his duty to stay.
American and Filipino troops have retreated to a peninsula called Bataan, where they are basically facing starvation and siege. Very quickly, they have to go down to half rations and then eventually to quarter rations, which is about 1,000 calories a day. That's not enough to live healthily in bed all day, to say nothing of trying to fight in foxholes. And there's another island off the tip of Bataan called Corregidor, where the Americans have their headquarters in a tunnel. And this is where the Americans will make their last stand, and Bataan will surrender on April 9th, 1942. This is the largest surrender of American forces in history, nearly 80,000. In fact, the Japanese will bring Wainwright to a radio studio in Manila, where they force him to make a broadcast.
Yesterday, I tendered to Lieutenant General Hummel, the Commander-in-Chief of the Imperial Japanese Forces in the Philippines, the surrender of the four harbor defense forts of Manila Bay.
How did Americans back home respond in 1942? They're losing this war to the Japanese. Things are going very badly, and suddenly there's one of their own generals who's being made to step up to the microphone. He's on the radio and surrendering.
Well, that's a great question, because Wainwright is very worried about what Americans back home will think of this decision that he made. In truth, he becomes a hero. Americans understand the difficult decision that he made. They know he fought to the very last chance he had. There were literally Japanese tanks pulling up to the entrance of the American headquarters and ready to proceed inside and carry out this massacre. So there really was no choice. And in fact, George Marshall back in Washington will make the proposal to give a Medal of Honor to Wainwright shortly after the surrender of the Philippines, and it would have gone forward, except one man said he would strongly speak out against it, and that man was Douglas MacArthur.
What?
Who had just received his own Medal of Honor.
For leaving.
Yes. General MacArthur was given a Medal of Honor when he reached Australia, and this is perhaps the most unusual Medal of Honor in American history. It was given to General MacArthur to offset Japanese propaganda about the captain deserting the sinking ship. General Marshall and President Roosevelt think about this, and they wonder how they can offset these charges that MacArthur has abandoned his forces in the Philippines. And what they come up with is to give MacArthur the one medal he's never received, the Medal of Honor.
And then MacArthur said, make sure not to give that medal to the guy that I left behind.
That is exactly what happens, and we have MacArthur's letter vetoing a Medal of Honor for General Wainwright. He says if it proceeds, he will be forced to release unsavory details about General Wainwright. And I think the implication here is that General Wainwright is an alcoholic.
Why did MacArthur care so much about denying an honor to the guy that he'd left behind?
MacArthur really was outraged that General Wainwright had made the decision to surrender the full Philippines. He seemed not to be able to process that Wainwright had done this because the Japanese were otherwise going to carry out a massacre in the American headquarters of 12 or 13,000 lives. But there was something larger. I think for MacArthur, the Medal of Honor always conjured the image of his father, who had received the Medal of Honor during the Civil War for charging up a ridge with the flag in his hand. And the thought of the medal going to someone who ordered the flag to be lowered at the sickening hour of surrender really struck MacArthur that he couldn't let that happen. And I think this was a great injustice, because what Wainwright did was every bit as heroic as anyone carrying the flag up a ridge. He stayed to see it lowered at the sickening hour of surrender when no one else wanted that job.
What was Wainwright's captivity like?
Well, so the Japanese had Wainwright as a prisoner of war, and they moved him from the Philippines to Taiwan, and eventually all the way to Manchuria, where he faces negative 49 degrees. He's tortured. He is beaten. The Japanese engage in what Wainwright will describe as systematic starvation. And in June 1945, you can see in Wainwright's diary, his health is breaking down. He thinks the war might last for another 2 years. He's totally cut off from information from the outside world. And he thinks he's not going to make it. And he writes this very moving entry in his diary where he says, I fought for life in the Philippines, and I'm going to fight for life with everything I have now. And I think that gives you a sense of what kind of man General Wainwright was.
When you think about his character and his personality, few of us hopefully will ever be in that situation that he was in. But are there lessons that you draw that you find yourself wanting to apply in your own life or wishing other people would?
One of the lessons I drew from General Wainwright is the importance of keeping your word and honor. And anyone can see it on the first page of his diary that he starts on April 2nd, 1942, when he says no other course of action would be honorable but to stay with my men and share their fate. That's a real leader.
Jonathan Horn is the author of The Fate of the Generals, MacArthur Wainwright and the Epic Battle for the Philippines. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
After World War II, President Harry S. Truman gave Jonathan Wainwright the Medal of Honor he'd been denied during his captivity. This is NPR News.
In her debut novel, What Will People Think?, author Sarah Hamden wanted her main character, Mia, to be more than just a stereotype.
And I just wanted to see if it was possible to write a really great story that happened to feature a Palestinian woman who is American and messy and funny and real and not just reduced to these headlines.
I'm Elsa Chang. That conversation on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. It's Memorial Day to remember and to honor those in uniform who gave their lives in service to their country. A wreath-laying ceremony is underway at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. President Trump is there and is scheduled to speak shortly. Millions of Americans are spending this holiday weekend away from home. NPR's Joel Rose has more.
The forecast from AAA is that we will see a record this holiday weekend with 45 million Americans traveling at least 50 miles from home. That is expected to break a record that has stood for 20 years. And it's mostly because of a record number of Americans driving this weekend. Drivers will find gas prices at their lowest levels on Memorial Day since 2021, according to Gas Buddy.
Russia launched another major drone attack on Ukraine last night for the third night in a row. Ukrainian officials say it was the largest aerial attack, 355 drones, since the war began more than 3 years ago. President Trump posted on social media that Russian President Vladimir Putin has gone, he said, absolutely crazy by stepping up attacks at a time when the U.S. is seeking a peace agreement. Global markets and the euro climbed today. The U.S. markets are closed for the Memorial Day holiday. This is NPR News. Texas is one step closer to requiring public schools to display the Ten Commandments in classrooms. Legislation is expected to clear a final vote in the next few days. It's almost certain to be challenged in court as violating the Constitution. A similar law passed in Louisiana and is being litigated in federal court. Police in Little River, South Carolina are investigating a mass shooting last night. At least 11 people were taken to hospitals. Police called it an isolated incident and said there's no risk to the community. Spain has a new sports hero. Yesterday, driver Alex Palou became the first Spaniard to win the famed Indianapolis 500. Quinn Kleinfelder from member station WDET has more.
Palou has earned three championships, but he'd never won on an oval speedway like Indy. And he says he had to take a chance to take the lead in the closing stages of the 500 after avoiding numerous wrecks on the track and in pit lane amid unusually cold weather.
The conditions were tricky, like you had to be very aggressive to make passes, and I think the level of the field as well is like super close. So in order to pass, you need to risk a lot.
It was a rough outing for Detroit-based Team Penske, which already had two cars penalized for using illegal parts before the race started and lost a third when it crashed while warming up. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump's trade wars have made it harder for agricultural producers to turn a profit. It's raised the cost of imported fertilizers and disrupted the markets abroad where they sell. But as Ray Solomon from member station KUNC reports, the sheep industry is cautiously optimistic.
Lorray Moon geeks out over sheep more than most.
I love them so much. I just kept buying sheep. So I'm in a Sheep Buyers Anonymous program.
These days, she keeps the herd to a modest 80 head spread across the family ranch on the outskirts of Craig, Colorado. She's also got a wool mill packed with machinery that combs and spins raw fleece, shorn right off the sheep, into soft, finger-pleasing yarn. From birthing the lambs to attaching labels on the yarn, she does it all.
We kind of based this whole company on doing what we could do right here close.
Her business doesn't really touch international markets at all. Even so, when Trump unveiled his sweeping 10% tariffs on foreign trade last month, she perked up.
I feel like it's an upswing for us.
Sheep producers are excited about the tariffs. The American Sheep Industry Association says the U.S. sheep industry is worth $5.1 billion, but has been in decline for decades. Cheaper imports from Australia and New Zealand are now three-quarters of the market. Mike Harper owns one of the country's largest sheep feedlots in Eaton, Colorado. He says at this point, American lamb is considered a premium product. The problem is that it looks too expensive to U.S. consumers used to cheap foreign imports.
Their undercutting is pretty substantially in pricing. The imports are.
The industry endorsed the tariffs on Australia and New Zealand, calling the 10% tax a good first step toward leveling the playing field for American producers. Harper says he's all for pricier imports, but these 10% tariffs aren't the ones he was hoping for.
It's probably not enough to make us competitive. If they'd have come out at 25 or 30%, I think that would have been impactful.
Harper says he's also worried about a bigger front in the current trade wars, China. He used to send his sheepskins there for processing. With the constantly changing tariff situation, he's not sure what he's going to do.
I mean, we can't just flip the switch and start doing it all here domestically. We're not set up for it.
But the outlook could be rosier down the line, according to Colorado State University ag economist Dom Thilmany.
If Australian and New Zealand wool and lamb look more expensive, you might actually see the supply of American sheep producers go up.
She says the laws of supply and demand tell us that if American sheep production ramps up, domestic prices would come down, possibly even enough to outcompete the imports. But
given it takes a while to raise a lamb into a marketable sheep, you're probably talking at least a 2 to 3 year lag.
And even then, Thilmany says sheep are just a tiny part of a massive economy rocked by tariffs.
It's an industry that's maybe 5% the size of the cattle industry. So sheep will see a relatively better day. It's just not going to be nearly enough to offset the shocks to all the other parts of the ag sector.
The biggest winners in these trade wars might just be the smallest, most locally oriented producers, like Lorraine Moon in her artisan wool mill. The way she sees it, the tariffs are changing the very conversation around consumption in her favor.
People are saying, well, I might buy less yarn, but I'm going to buy a really good one, and I'm going to know the farmer, and I'm going to know its story.
Which means her sheep obsession could finally pay off in the marketplace. For NPR News, I'm Ray Solomon in Craig, Colorado.
In about 24 states, immigrant students who have protection under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, can pay in-state tuition for college, which can mean big savings. But amid a broader crackdown on illegal immigration, that discount is at risk. From member station WUSF, Nancy Guan reports that Florida is getting rid of the benefit.
In the hallway of Seminole State College in Sanford, Florida, Hernan stares at the photos of alumni hanging on the walls.
They're pretty professional people. She graduated in 2018. Maybe one day I'll be here too.
Hernan asked that we not use his last name because he fears being targeted for his immigration status. His family brought him to the U.S. from Mexico as a child, and he has protection under DACA. But the program is facing court challenges. Hernan is a junior studying construction management. He's worked in landscaping since he was 16 and says a bachelor's degree will get him further in his career.
I will need this for higher, like manager or even corporate positions, like up there. I feel that if I don't have this right now, I can't begin my life.
He needs about 9 more classes in order to graduate. But a new state law scheduled to go into effect later this year could delay Hernan's future. The law gets rid of a waiver that has allowed students with DACA protections to pay the same in-state tuition rate as their U.S. citizen peers if they attended a Florida high school for 3 years. These students can't access federal financial aid or state aid in most cases, When lawmakers created the waiver a decade ago, they believed it would give young people like Hernan a chance at higher education. But attitudes have changed.
It is immoral to charge people who shouldn't even be in the country a vastly discounted price.
That was former Florida State Senator, now Congressman Randy Fine, speaking at a committee meeting in January. He and other lawmakers who supported eliminating the tuition benefit argue that it encourages illegal immigration. And now thousands are at risk of losing the waiver, according to Florida's university and college systems. Diego Sanchez is with the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration, a group that tracks these tuition policies.
They didn't just block future students. They basically pulled the rug out from under students who are already enrolled, already paying, who relied on this waiver, and many who were already on track to graduate.
Sanchez says Republican legislatures in at least three states with in-state tuition for DACA students have also tried to reverse their policies this year. But so far, Florida is the only one that succeeded. Hernan says he's expecting his tuition to triple. To finish his remaining courses, it'll cost him about $15,000 instead of $4,000. But he smiles and says he's staying positive.
We just gotta adapt. That's one of my favorite words, adapt. I gotta adapt to the changes, you know, in current society, you know.
He says he's thinking about applying for private scholarships or loans that can cover the extra costs, or maybe taking a year off to work full-time and save up.
I consider this state my home, and it will be my home until the last stage, you know, where they kick me out or they deport me. But as far, I'm gonna keep fighting.
Fighting, he says, for whatever it takes to earn his degree. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Guan in Sanford, Florida.
This is NPR News.
Five years after the murder of George Floyd, the racial justice movement faces backlash. One advocate still has hope. Next time on Here and Now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. The Indy 500 is considered the greatest spectacle in racing, but this year a new competition stole the show, the Weenie 500. The six Wienermobiles faced off for the first time to decide which would be crowned top dog. The Oscar Mayer marketing machines did not disappoint. After two laps around the iconic Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the victory went to the Wiener repping the Southeast, known as Slaw Dog. The margin of victory, half a bun. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Torpedo baseball bats hit it big when the New York Yankees set a new team record with 9 home runs in a game early this season. People noticed the oddly shaped bats that seemed to give players more pop at the plate. Alana Schreiber with member station WWNO in New Orleans visited one of the companies making bats that are all the rage.
I'm in heaven. This is a baseball lover's dream.
I'm standing in a conference room at Marucci Sports in Baton Rouge. Bats line the walls all the way up to the ceiling. They're one of the top companies making these new torpedo bats. I'm with Kurt Ainsworth, co-founder and CEO. Even he was amazed at how much people were talking about these bats.
It was not your normal just ESPN or MLB Network talking about baseball. It was people with Fox News and CNN talking about baseball. So it became everybody that's not even baseball fans know about torpedo.
Anyone who looks at a torpedo bat can tell. What makes them unique is their shape.
I mean, it looks like a bowling pin. I mean, they call it a torpedo because it sounds cooler, but it really does look like a bowling pin.
Traditional bats get bigger the higher up you go, but torpedo bats bulge out about 3/4 of the way up and thin out at the top. In other words, there's a bigger sweet spot.
It's basically taking the girth and the size of the end of the bat and moving it into the hitting space, so it gives the player a better chance for success.
So let's say a major leaguer wants a torpedo bat. First, he comes to Baton Rouge. Here, he'll meet with Micah Gibbs at Marucci's Baseball Performance Lab. He's worked with some of the MLB's biggest stars.
Paul Goldschmidt, Nolan Arenado, Alex Bregman, Francisco Lindor.
Gibbs says a lot goes into finding the perfect bat for a player.
We have a fitting matrix. We have a bunch of different bats, different weights, weight distributions. We put them through an entire physical assessment before they even start swinging.
But once they do start swinging, Gibbs takes a video and a computer analyzes the player as they hit. Wherever they make the most contact, that's where the bat will be thicker.
So the bats come in as a billet of wood, and we will cut it into the shape of the bat, whatever that player specified for their bat.
That's Sager Allen, a wood operator. He's showing me the factory side of the business, where they cut and sand every bat.
We have, I want to say, over 70,000 different models we can cut and make, so there's definitely an art form to it.
After the bats are cut, sanded, and weighed, they head over to the painting department, where they're eventually inscribed with the player's often illegible signature. Then they're shipped to the athletes to test out. But I wanted to test out these bats, too. We head to Marucci's on-site batting cages, the same ones where major leaguers are getting fitted. But I'm not worried. I've played 2 seasons in an adult softball league. I've brought along Marty Sullivan. He's an LSU sports reporter, and today, my pitcher. He starts throwing, and I start swinging.
It's always more of an opposite field kind of hitter.
And you can feel it. The sweet spot is bigger. So big, in fact, that earlier in the season, some wondered if the bats might get banned. But Tyler Kepner, senior baseball writer for The Athletic, isn't too worried.
I think it's just an innovation for the hitters, honestly. And we've seen a lot of advancements the last few years in pitching technology. And so I think this is just, one time when the hitters are fighting back a little bit.
In other words, baseball is constantly evolving. And these torpedo bats are just the latest innovation in pushing the limits of the game. For NPR News, I'm Alana Schreiber in Baton Rouge.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Ukraine controls just a third of its eastern province of Donetsk. One holdout town has been under constant Russian assault since 2014. But many residents of Slovyansk are determined to stay. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley visited the last maternity ward in a region surrounded by Russian forces.
Sounds of new life resound through the hallways of Slovyansk City Hospital, which has the last working maternity ward in Ukrainian-held Donbass.
Hello.
Meet pediatrician and hospital director Volodymyr Ivanenko. A large map of Ukraine hangs on the wall over his desk. He says when Russia invaded in 2022, many staff members fled, but almost everyone's returned, working through missile strikes and electricity and water cuts.
We are a Ukrainian health institution and must provide care until the last moment. Whether it's dangerous or not is another issue. It's a job, just like sitting in a trench. You have to work for something.
In room number 9, new mother Anastasia holds her one-day-old daughter, Vasilisa. It's a private moment she's happy to share briefly, but doesn't want to give their family name. She also has a 1.5-year-old. She wants to stay in this town where she grew up and her whole family still lives.
It's always better to be at home than somewhere else.
For now, she doesn't have to explain the daily sirens to her children or why some buildings in town lie in rubble. I asked the young mother if she'd prefer Slovyansk be under Russian or Ukrainian control. Some Ukrainians in the East have traditionally felt closer to Russia than Kyiv, though that has changed since the war.
I don't care what kind of peace we have. I just want my children to live with nothing flying over their heads.
The doctor who's been showing us around pulls me aside. Valentina Hushenko says this question of Russia or Ukraine ripped families apart in 2014 when Kremlin-backed separatists briefly took over Slovyansk.
And when the 2022 invasion came, it was a total catastrophe. But to try not to hurt or offend, we don't have these conversations anymore. Everyone just tries to live their life.
Plushenko says people hold on as long as possible because going somewhere else means paying rent.
Are you from Slovyansk?
No, from Kramatorsk.
Kristina Dyshenko from nearby Kramatorsk says her contractions have begun. Her husband, Valentin, says he's worried about the safety of their first child.
Nothing good will happen to Donetsk. We're going to have to leave.
The couple wants to move to a safer place like the Kyiv suburbs. Dyshenko says before President Trump was elected, he thought Ukraine would keep part of Donetsk province in a peace settlement. But now he thinks Trump and Russia will take it away. All hope is gone, he says. Little kids frolic in a playground next to the Slovyansk town hall, whose entrance is buttressed by sandbags. Out front are giant portraits of the town's sons who've fallen in battle. 5-year-old Artem plays cops and robbers as his father, Dmitry Kluchnikov, looks on. Air raid sirens begin to go off. I ask if his son knows what's going on.
Yes, he knows the Russians are bombing us. He hates them. They're the bad guys.
So will they stay?
I understand they want Donetsk. And if for any reason they get it, we will leave.
They have killed so many people, says Kluchnikov. We will never live in the country of the killers. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Slovyansk, Ukraine.
It's graduation season, the time for seniors to don their hard-earned caps and gowns and celebrate.
That also means commencement addresses from politicians, entertainers, activists, and Kermit.
You're all here to listen to a frog in a very tiny cap and gown give a commencement speech.
Kermit the Frog spoke at the University of Maryland's Kermencement about working with people to get ahead.
Rather than jumping over someone to get what you want, consider reaching out your hand and taking the leap side by side, because life is better when we leap together.
Actress Jennifer Coolidge told the graduates at Emerson College to be, well, delusional about their dreams.
My mother had a magazine in the living room, and it had Grace Kelly on the cover, and inside there was a full photo spread of her lavish royal wedding, and a story about how she became the Queen of Monaco. And it was all in this moment that I realized that I wanted to be Queen of Monaco.
And her advice about how to go about reaching a dream?
When you find the thing that you want to do, I really want to highly recommend just frigging go for it.
Now, some speakers took a political tack, like actor and activist Jane Fonda. She urged the class at the USC Annenberg School of Communication to use their rights to guard against polarization, uncertainty, and climate change.
Vote all the way down the ballot. That means don't forget the sheriff, the school board, public utilities, the city council. You would be amazed at how much power these down-ballot offices can wield when it comes to democracy and climate.
Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Reading Rainbow's LeVar Burton offered this counsel to students at Howard University about navigating what he sees as the promises and prejudices of the United States.
Only in America could a descendant of slaves for whom simply knowing how to read just a few generations ago, a crime punishable by whipping or death, could grow up and become a celebrated champion for literacy and the written word. This, too, is America.
And he's encouraged the graduates to use their gifts to build a brighter future.
Use them liberally and to your best advantage, and know in your heart of hearts that in the words of one of my very favorite wordsmiths, Kendrick Lamar, we gonna be all right.
We gonna be all right. We gonna be all right.
Congratulations to all the graduates. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
And when I wake up, I recognize you're looking at me for the pay cut. But I'm gonna stop looking at you from the face down.
You ain't gonna bother me no more. No how. Love goes just so far, no more. Woke up this morning.